Men have always had the dream of building a perfect world. Plato, the Greek philosopher, called his ideal society the Republic. Thomas More, the lawyer of Tudor England, called his Utopia. Karl Marx, the revolutionary, called his the Classless Society. And there have been many other names for it too. But by whatever name it's known, men have always felt the need for such a dream to give direction to their social existence. It's as if existence only has meaning for us in the light of such an ultimate purpose. So long as we believe that the future holds some better prospect than the past, then a man's labour has joy and motivation in it. But if that vision should fade, if man should become collectively pessimistic about the future, then that pessimism quickly turns to a defeatist apathy. What's the point of going on, he says. Now the Jews in the days of Ezekiel were suffering just such an enfeebling loss of hope. Despair had taken a long while to arrive with them, mainly because the sense of purpose that the Jews enjoyed was so extraordinarily vigorous and entrenched in their minds. In spite of their political insignificance, Israel had clung for centuries to the passionate belief in her own greatness and the indestructibility of her national destiny. She was unique. She was the covenant people of God. She read it in her scriptures. She celebrated it in her worship. So whatever catastrophes might overtake the Jews, whatever might overtake her neighbours, the Jews would be safe, they believed. God had promised. Right up to the very end, this confidence had been retained. True, things looked pretty bad on the political scene. But some dramatic reversal of fortune was bound to occur, they said. It had to. Well, so they believed, tenaciously, for many, many years. But in the final event, no dramatic reversal did take place. If you look in Ezekiel chapter 33, the chapter before we read, you'll come across what is in many ways a key verse in the whole of this prophecy. Chapter 33, verse 21. Ezekiel says, "In the 12th year of our exile, in the 10th month on the 5th day, a man who had escaped from Jerusalem came to me and said, 'The city has fallen.'" So the unimaginable, you see, had happened. Jerusalem, the center and symbol of Jewish national destiny, was no more. It had been razed to the ground by the Babylonians. And it was a crippling blow. The last thread of Israel's tattered pride had snapped. Her morale had held up amazingly under Babylonian supremacy. But now surely she had run out of dreams. That sense of destiny that had so long supported and energized her, surely that was irreparably shattered. Not even a delusion of grandeur remained to Judah. And so she stood on the threshold of that collective despair that spells the death of a culture. And yet the miracle in many ways of the book of Ezekiel and of the last part of the Old Testament is that though she tottered on the brink of national suicide at this point in her history, the Jews never actually took the plunge. Somehow, that crazy dream of a better day wasn't extinguished. A new confidence, in fact, was injected into it, and that from a most unexpected source. Ezekiel. Now, if you've been following this series at all over the last few weeks, you'll know that Ezekiel had been predicting this fall of Jerusalem for years. He had preached it, he had dramatized it, he had allegorized it. All in all, he had used just about every bizarre and eccentric device he could think of to prepare his fellow exiles for this tragedy which had now happened. And with very little response all that time. Well, now at last his words had been proven true. You might have thought that of all the Jews, he would be the only man who gained some satisfaction from the arrival of this messenger. Indeed, I'm sure if I'd been Ezekiel, I'd have been very tempted to say, told you, sir. But the fascinating thing is that far from using this opportunity to rub salt into Israel's wound, far from being the signal for more denunciations of the people's sins, Ezekiel 33, verse 21, that verse which tells us that the city at last had fallen, that in fact becomes a turning point of the whole tone of Ezekiel's prophecy. From being a prophet of judgment, Ezekiel is released, quite literally, overnight, to become a prophet of hope. And tonight and next Sunday evening, we're just going to try to get some flavour, some understanding of that new and more optimistic Ezekiel who appears in the latter chapters of his prophecy. And of this new dream with which he sought to fire the vision and aspiration of the people at this critical point in their history. Now tonight we begin with Ezekiel 34. It's a rather beautiful extended metaphor on the theme of the shepherd. For our convenience, we'll just divide the passage into two parts. The first 10 verses, dealing with the shepherds who failed, and the last 20 verses, dealing with the shepherd who is to come. Let's look first at the shepherds who failed. Verse 2. Son of man, he says, prophesy against the shepherds of Israel. One of the major reasons why utopian dreams fail to materialize in general is the inability of human society to establish a reliable and just government for itself. Power is a very ambiguous thing. It can be angelic, it can also be demonic. If we look in the book of Revelation, the lamb and the beast have two things in common. They both have horns of power, and they both wear many crowns. The potential, then, which political power possesses for good is exactly matched by a contrary potential for evil. And whether good or evil flow out of the exercise of power depends totally upon the quality and character of those who wield it. And that's really the lesson of these 10 verses in Ezekiel 34. The shepherds of whom Ezekiel is speaking are not really the pastoral men who looked after the herds in the wilderness. This is a parable. These shepherds represent the royal court of Israel, the government, as we would say. It was a very appropriate metaphor, for of course, David, the founder of the dynasty of Judah, before his elevation to monarchy, had tended the flocks of his father. And one of the great psalms of Israel, Psalm 78 in its closing verses, reminded the people of this. He chose David, his servant. He took him from the sheep pens, from tending the sheep. He brought him to be the shepherd of his people Jacob, of Israel, his inheritance. And David shepherded them with integrity of heart and with skillful hands. He led them. So you see, according to the psalmist, David's professional background as a herdsman was no mere accident of history. In a very real sense, the shepherd is God's ideal king, blending as he does authority with care, strength with tenderness. Ezekiel is saying here, God looks for pastoral qualities in leadership. But regrettably, though he had found them in David himself, they were notably lacking in his successors. That's what Ezekiel is complaining about. Prophesy against the shepherds of Israel. Prophesy and say, woe to the shepherds who only take care of themselves. Shouldn't shepherds take care of the flock? Notice Ezekiel specifies several aspects of this failure of the government to really care and shepherd as they should have done. In verse 3, he mentions exploitation. You eat the curds, clothe yourselves with the wool, and slaughter the choice animals, but you don't take care of the flock. In other words, you feather your own nest out of your political power. Francis Bacon, wasn't it, who said, money is like muck. Not good unless it's spread around a bit. But the trouble with political power is that all too often it gives men the chance to feather their own nests materially. Moses had recognized that and had, for that reason, constitutionally banned royal financial reserves. The king shall not accumulate silver and gold, he said. But ever since the time of Solomon, the temptation had been far too great for the royal house of Judah. Pretty soon a class division had arisen, just as wise old Samuel had always warned the people that it would. The royal aristocracy lived in luxury out of the taxes and labor of the people. You are milking the country's economy, says Ezekiel. You are fleecing the country to line your own pockets. Woe to the shepherds who exploit the sheep. On top of that, he complains of their tyranny in verse 4. You have not strengthened the weak or healed the sick or bound up the injured. You've not brought back the strays or searched for the lost. Instead, you've ruled harshly and brutally. God expects governments to stand up not only for justice but also for oppression. The weak and the vulnerable within society ought to be their special concern. Just as the feeble and hurt members of a flock receive the special attention of the shepherd, so God expects governments to have a compassion, a concern for those who are weak and vulnerable in society. But in Israel, it was a case of the survival of the fittest, complains Ezekiel. The monarchy became increasingly autocratic, increasingly brutal, increasingly merciless. And on top of this, he complains thirdly of their irresponsibility. Verses 5 and 6. So the sheep were scattered, because there was no real shepherd to lead them. And when they were scattered, they became food for all the wild animals. My sheep wandered over all the mountains and every high hill, and no one searched or looked for them. The government displayed no remorse for the social disintegration that was the consequence of their self-indulgent policies. They presided over an ever-weakening and ever more disunited nation. But they couldn't care less. The sheep became food for all the wild animals, or as we would say, to put it in contemporary terms, the country is going to the dogs. But the government didn't lift a finger. Now, Ezekiel's clear that this gross negligence on the part of the rulers of Judah was a major cause for the mess the people were in. They must take a large share of the blame, he says, for the collapse of hope to which the nation was now a victim as a result of the fall of Jerusalem. It's the shepherds who must take the large share of the blame. Verse 7, therefore, you shepherds, hear the word of the Lord, as surely as I live. Because my flock lacks a shepherd, and so has been plundered. See, that's the reason for it. That's why it's been plundered, and has become food for all the wild animals. And because my shepherds did not search for my flock out, but cared for themselves rather than for my flock, hear the word of the Lord, I am against the shepherds, and will hold them accountable for my flock. Notice that word, accountable. It has a very important application in the whole field of political leadership and our response to it. The whole question of government accountability is a major problem of political philosophy. Who is the government accountable to? Some argue that governments are accountable only to themselves. That general school of thought leads to totalitarianism. Some argue that the government is accountable to the people. It's generally speaking, the kind of democratic view that's common in the West. See, the Bible endorses neither of those. The Bible believes neither in the sovereignty of the state nor the sovereignty of the electorate. It believes in the sovereignty of God. My shepherds, God calls these leaders. My shepherds. The Bible insists that all governments are accountable for their actions to God. And that is true of pagan and secular societies, no less than the sort of explicitly theocratic nation that Israel was. For we find Daniel saying similar things to Nebuchadnezzar, Jesus saying similar things to Pilate, Paul saying similar things to the Roman Imperium of his day. The powers that be are appointed by God. They wield his sword. So what Ezekiel is saying here, you see, applies just as much to the government of this country or of any country in this world as it did to Israel. They are my shepherd. They are accountable to me. When God looks at a government, it is their sense of moral responsibility for the people who are in their care that he is most concerned to examine. That's, I think, very important. Ezekiel is not standing up here like a socialist to denounce the monarchy as an institution. The Bible isn't prejudiced towards Republicans. Neither does he stand up as some liberal complaining about the lack of parliamentary opposition in the monarchy of Israel. The Bible's not prejudiced towards the Democrats. He doesn't stand up as a Marxist criticizing the capitalism of the country, nor as an anarchist criticizing the existence of government itself. No. He stands up using his platform of a prophetic authority to denounce not the political complexion of his society, but the actual way that power was being used in his society. I think that's very important we notice that. For the Christian church has existed under all kinds of regimes and has sometimes made the mistake of thinking that it ought to identify with particular political programs. In the 1600s, a civil war was fought in Britain over whether Christians should be royalists or parliamentarians. To read some modern writers, you would think that liberal democracy was synonymous with Christian government. Listen to old Lord Soper, who used to preach on Tower Hill in London, the British Methodist. You would think that Christians had no option but to be socialists. According to some radicals in the Third World, Marxism is the natural political expression of Christianity. So it goes on. Well, we don't find that sort of thing in the prophets. Ezekiel is not saying that Jerusalem fell because she had departed from some approved system. Preeminently, he says she fell because she departed, her leaders departed, from moral responsibility in the exercise of the power they wielded. No doubt some socio-economic systems are better than others. No doubt we would learn an awful lot about what makes a good socio-economic system by studying the law of Moses. But the criterion by which these systems are evaluated is not doctrinaire politics, but the accountability of those who actually wield power in society. Ezekiel is giving us tests here. He's saying, is justice done? Are the weak protected? Is human life valued? Is there tyranny? Is there compassion? Is there responsibility in society? That's what God is looking for when he evaluates society, the moral consequences of leadership. He doesn't say you're not democratic enough or you're not socialist enough. He says you don't care enough, government. I put you there to be shepherds, and you're not caring for the flock. If it has application, though, to the whole field of politics, certainly I think this passage does. It has even more application, you know, to the field of leadership within the church. For, of course, Israel was not only a model nation. It's also a model of the kingdom of God. The church in the Old Testament. And that emphasis is very much present here in the warmth of those personal pronouns. You see how God speaks in this passage again and again. My flock, my flock. Though God is the king of every nation and the lord of every government and therefore holds every government accountable, he is the king of his church in a very unique way. For she's precious to him. My flock. She belongs to him in a way that no other flock does. And for that reason, those whom God appoints to serve as leaders in the church exercise a function which is more noble and more responsible than any prime minister or president in this world. That's worth thinking about, isn't it? Be shepherds of the church of God, which he bought with his own blood. That was Paul's advice to the elders of Ephesus. He bought it with his own blood. If the kings of Israel were judged for their irresponsibility, if the governments of the nations are judged for their irresponsibility, how much worse punishment will those who prove negligent as leaders of the body of Christ incur? God is not so bothered whether we call them bishops or elders or vicars or pastors, but he is concerned with their quality, the shepherds of Israel. So much then for the shepherds who failed. But what of the shepherd to come? Look at verse 11. This is what the sovereign Lord says, I myself will search for my sheep and look after them. As a shepherd looks after his scattered flock when he is with them, so will I look after my sheep. If Ezekiel had been writing this chapter a few months earlier, I have no doubt that it would have stopped at verse 10. No doubt about that at all. Ezekiel had complained on previous occasions about the deficiencies of the leadership. If you were here last week, we were looking at one such passage. I looked for a man to stand in the breach, he said, didn't he? And I found none. And it was on that pessimistic note that that chapter ended. And every chapter has ended in Ezekiel up till now. For at that time, before 33 verse 21, before the fall of Jerusalem, Ezekiel's prophetic imagination was not permitted to see beyond the darkness and terror of that imminent Holocaust. But now, quite suddenly, a new dawn has broken on Ezekiel's thought. He sees beyond verse 10. He sees beyond the judgment of the leadership that failed. A new expectation. Verse 4. All right, the leadership had failed. All right, Israel's hopes of an immediate utopia based on David's dynasty had failed with it. But all was not lost. For if man couldn't do the job properly, God himself was going to show them how. He would come and lead the flock as they were meant to be led, he said. Notice the things which this divine rule, this direct rule from heaven, if you like. You know, some people talk about direct rule from Westminster for Northern Ireland, don't they? Well, this is direct rule from heaven for the people of God that we're reading about here, verse 11. See some of the consequences it's going to mean. It's going to mean salvation, he says in verse 12. I will rescue them from all the places where they were scattered. It's going to mean restoration in verse 13. A regathering of them as one people, bringing them out of the countries where they were scattered. It's going to mean prosperity. In verse 14, the exploited flock would once again be fed properly. In verse 16, the weak and the crippled would once again be cared for properly. It's going to mean justice. For in verse 17, we read, once again, judgment would be administered, and those opportunists who had taken advantage of the weakness of the government to oppress their neighbors would be condemned by God's rule. Altogether, they would enjoy unparalleled security. Look at verse 25. A covenant of peace, God calls it. Ridding the land of wild beasts. In other words, no external aggressor would threaten them. No internal lack would threaten them. I will provide for them, he says, a land renowned for its crops, in verse 29. There'll be no more victims of famine. They would enjoy the blessing of a fully conscious relationship with God. They will know that I, the Lord their God, am with them. And they are my people. And on top of all this, says Ezekiel, God would ensure that this happy and blessed state of affairs could never again be forfeited by bad leadership. For he himself would provide a leader for them. Verse 23. I will place over them one shepherd, my servant David. He will tend them and be their shepherd. So you see, this is one of those dramatic passages of the Old Testament which speak of a future messianic kingdom, of a miraculous, a supernatural heir of David coming to set up a new kingdom with the power of God upon him, which will be supremely blissful, supremely prosperous. The vital question we have to ask, of course, is how does God intend that this vision of utopia, if you like, which Ezekiel encourages the people in their loss of Jerusalem, how does God intend that prophecy to be fulfilled? It's a very important question, and it's one on which Christians are to some extent divided. Some say that we today must still look to the future for the literal accomplishment of the things of which Ezekiel speaks here. In some glorious millennial future age, they say, the Jewish people themselves will be politically reunited, as Ezekiel prophesied. Indeed, they say the reoccupation of Palestine that we've seen in this century is a first step in that direction. Well, that may be. I have to confess myself not totally convinced on that point. What I am convinced about is that if you read this chapter to the early church, they would not have interpreted the passage that way. They wouldn't have said, ah, well, this means that Israel will come back to Palestine one day. Now, as far as they were concerned, the messianic kingdom of which the prophets spoke, Jeremiah, Isaiah, Ezekiel, and all the others, that messianic kingdom of which the Old Testament spoke, that was not any longer for them a millennial dream. When the early church read these prophecies, they read them as concrete historical reality, upon the very threshold of which they were standing. Let all Israel be assured of this, cried Peter at Pentecost. God has made this Jesus, whom you crucified, Lord and Messiah. So the New Testament does not look for a political fulfillment of these ancient prophecies. They were cast in a political form, we may speculate, because the people of God in that time were a political kingdom. But the New Testament church was a spiritual company, and accordingly the New Testament looks primarily for a spiritual fulfillment of these promises. And that is why Jesus stood and said, I am the good shepherd. He was identifying himself with this very chapter. I am the good shepherd. All those other false messiahs who've come before me, they were robbers. They weren't shepherds. I am the good shepherd. And the salvation of which he speaks in John 10 is not a political salvation, but a spiritual salvation. Life eternal. The restored unity of which he speaks in John 10 is not within the boundaries of some political nation, but within the spiritual boundaries of his own body, there will be one flock and one shepherd. The prosperity of which he speaks is not some physical economic prosperity, but the spiritual pasture, the manna from heaven, the covenant of peace of which he speaks is not some bizarre earthly paradise centered around Jerusalem, where wild animals are mysteriously tamed and crops grow in miraculous abundance. No, he says, peace I leave with you. Not as the world gives, do I give to you. Do not let your hearts be troubled. As far as the early church was concerned, the peace of God already ruled in the hearts of God's people. It may be that when that day comes, when the kingdom of God finally declares itself openly, that we shall see some aspects of Ezekiel 34 fulfilled with a new literalness. I'm not discounting that possibility. But what I am sure of is that this prophecy that Ezekiel gives us here is not written about the Jews, nor is it intended for the Jews. It's intended for us. It's written about the church. It's written for us. And the promises and the vision which Ezekiel 34 contains are relevant, therefore, to us, not to some far-off day. And it seems to me, therefore, this is a passage we should be studying with real sense of engagement and interest, not just academic interest. We should be reading it as an heir reads the will, with a sense of lively involvement and benefit from it. For you see, we live in a day, in our secular world, where we are victim to exactly the same kind of gigantic loss of hope, which is Israel was suffering from when Ezekiel spoke these words. The symbols of our utopian dreams have been smashed just as surely as Israel's were when Jerusalem fell. Up until quite recently, that wasn't so. Up till perhaps 30 years ago, the dominant mood of Western civilization was optimistic. Science and technology had provided us with fresh utopian dreams, an age of plenty, an age of leisure, an age of international cooperation. All these things seemed imminent. The Bible had got things the wrong way round, people were saying. The Garden of Eden lies in the future, not in the past. But in these last few years, that kind of confidence has almost totally collapsed. The science and technology in which man trusted has become a voracious tyrant, consuming his energy resources, polluting his environment, destroying the very oxygen he breathes. An acute premonition of self-destruction is plaguing our world today. A great fear of nuclear disaster, of ecological catastrophe. It's everywhere around. People are losing hope. Where is the realist of the 1980s? To look for a sense of destiny. But a Christian has it. He can find a perspective on human history which recognizes the bankruptcy of all these human utopian dreams, and yet which still looks toward the future with confidence and a sense of purpose. There's an optimism that can survive the nuclear holocaust and the ecological disaster. There's a hope which can lift up men's head even in the midst of a universe which is going up in flames. Ezekiel found it as he sat there in exile with the weeping people of the exile around him, mourning for the country they loved. And we can find it too, in our day and generation. For it was a hope that is not centered on the discovery of some new technology, nor on the implementation of some new political theory. All such solutions are at best temporary and fragile. No, Ezekiel's hope was centered on a person, on Christ, and on the kingdom, God's kingdom, that he would inaugurate. And for us in the 1980s, that kingdom is not a far-off dream, nor should we preach it as such. The kingdom of heaven has in a real sense arrived, and we, like the early church before us, are on the threshold of it. That's how we should present it to people. The king has come. We do not depress people with pessimistic doctrines that the devil is in charge of this world. He isn't. God has raised Jesus from the dead and made him sit at his right hand, far above all rule and authority and power and dominion. God has highly exalted him. Not will exalt him, he has exalted him. And he shall reign until every enemy is under his feet. So we are not meant to be pessimists. We Christians should be the last people to be pessimists. This is why the Christian should be involved in politics. This is why the Christian should be involved in evangelism. Because the kingdom is imminent. Because the king is coming. Indeed, he's here in our hearts. His covenant of peace is already available to us. We ought not to allow ourselves to be pressurized and silenced and compromised by the world. Christ is the king. And in the spiritual armor that he provides, with the sword of the Spirit in our hands, we do battle against the principalities and powers of wickedness. The king is on our side. Well, there may be persecution and difficulty for us as we try and stand for that vision. For the great tribulation is a present experience of the saints as well as a future one. And there may well be conflicts, for Armageddon is a battle that every Christian is called to fight in, not just the Latter-day Saints. But we do not give in to secular pessimism. There is much that can be done, much that must be done, before the king will be openly crowned and his reign over his enemies become manifest. Death is the last enemy to be destroyed. I fear many Christians wait for the resurrection of the dead as if one had to wait for that before we could start campaigning for the kingdom. But that is not what Paul says. He says death is the last enemy to be destroyed. That's the last thing on God's agenda. Why should we wait for the resurrection from the dead before we start presenting our reigning Jesus to the world? Ezekiel found hope in the very jaws of despair. We ought to. Let's pray together.